And James Winston Morris will know that he's a wonderful scholar of international repute and a longtime friend of Threshold, and it's always a joy to have him with us.
And it's a joy to be here. Thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There's a little handout going around. Let me say a couple things because I don't want it to distract you. You might. First of all, I made 60 copies. It was more or less what Rahima said would be here. So if we're short at all, those of you, there are two or three people, are couples in one way or another, traveling together, married, whatever, share it. You know, so make sure everybody gets a copy to look at. I don't know. Is this thing, have I got this on right or is it backwards? It's okay. It sort of feels strange to have wires sticking out of my ears, but I'll get used to it. It's a new kind of microphone, I guess. You can hear me all right? Does everybody can hear it back there? Very well. Okay. Let me just say about I'll say more about the handout, but basically, apart from the little translation of the quatrain, I'll say a lot more about it, and we'll hear in just a moment at the right, on the upper right-hand corner of the first page. It's really to take home. I always do this because I feel like if I fail when I'm up here, at least you can take Rumi home and he'll succeed. That's basically the theory behind the handout. So hopefully I won't, and you won't need it so much. But this is kind of... when you go on a pilgrimage, in almost any tradition, and certainly, I know the word in Iran, you have to bring candy back to everybody. Like in Iran, they call it sugati, and wherever your pilgrimage is to, you have to bring it back. You bring back zamzam water from the Hajj and so forth. So just consider this my candy box for things to take home. Okay. So what I'd like to really talk about here is something that... basically, it's the fruits of my study of Book 3, and by study, I mean just like really intensely plunging into it in the last 2 or 3 weeks, because I look back at what I'd done. It was always seemed to be the handouts were about Ibn Arabi, and I'm actually working on talks and translations for 2 events in New York in a couple of weeks and then another month on the same muraqabah, muhasabah, on the same intimate life of the soul and so forth, and I didn't want to... It wouldn't be recycling, it'd be the first try, but I didn't want to do that again. It's bad adab with Mevlana. So I really kept looking, where can I find this answer about how do we go about returning to the source of love? It's an endless topic, and quickly found myself plunging in, or pulled into Book 3 of the Masnavi. You might think scholars read everything they supposedly teach. It's not true, as teachers here know. I teach a lot, the 1st and 6th books and the turning point between the 3rd and 4th books, but I rarely delve into other books of the Masnavi. And this was such an exciting and difficult experience that what I've ended up here with, and Corey knows I started out with about 50 pages, and basically, what is that thing when the prophet goes to Moses in the Hadith of the Miraj, and Moses says, no way, they're going to do 50 prayers, you know, let's cut it down, go back to God, get a permission, and then it's like 10 times a day, and it comes back, Moses says, you know, I know my people, you know, this is not going to work, you've got to go back. And finally God says, 5, and they count as 50. You know, so basically my experience with how much of the Book 3 of the Masnavi I wanted to bring was kind of like that. I'd go to Corey and she'd say, you know, way too much to hand out. She said, no more than 2 pages. Well, I compromised finally, and I've got some pages you can take home, but we'll stick to the first 2 pages here. And... what this is really about, I came up with a title, but I really changed the title in the way I look at it today, is not so much when returning seems hard, which is the truthful title even a few days ago when I was cutting and pasting here, but more about how do we learn from returning, or what are we learning while we're returning? And let me put that in a very simple way. If you've realized that in some way each of us is a breath of the divine spirit, or a ruh, or wah, in the plural, if one realizes that, we're faced with kind of mystery about our life here on earth, and there are only so many possible answers. One is that the ruh is pure and perfect, and it's kind of been lured down or tricked down or tempted down or in some way ended up here, and it really just needs to escape. So testing becomes the process by which we escape from a place we shouldn't perhaps have been in the first place, and we just got there because we were like bad kids who got sent down. Those are called Gnostics in the history of religion. That's certainly not the monotheistic answer. But you know, when you look at people around us and we look at ourselves when we find ourselves in desperate situations, that's when we're tempted to kind of say, well, why, if life is so grim, why am I here? Why don't I just, you know, go back to the better place, the place, the source of love from which we're pretty, even the most depressed and of us and despairing really think that there is some better place than that. So that's one answer, not the one of Rumi or anybody we'd talk about here. Another one is that we're come here to be tested in the sense of our obedience, of our perhaps our listening ability and our obedience. And that's one way of looking at each of the monotheistic traditions, is simply that if we listen and obey very well, we'll be rewarded with gardens and all sorts of wonderful things. If we don't, we'll either for a part time or for a longer time have to suffer the consequences of our disobedience, like disobedient children. Again, interestingly enough, that's not what the Masnavi is about or much of Rumi at all. And the third possibility is we're here to learn, and that our suffering and our trials and our all of these things we have to go through on earth, and I say we here in the sense of all of us, that they're really about learning. In this first passage from the Masnavi, Nicholson translates this as transformation. But in any case, there's a kind of learning, awareness, deeper awareness, transubstantiation, I would say might be a better word, for what goes on as we pass through all the different learning processes here in life and earth. And in a way, the whole Masnavi is just this immense... I want to say something about this, because how many of you are actually doing... I notice everybody's into study groups of the Masnavi. How many of you are really familiar with it? I know what you've gone all the way through it once and are starting again in Kentucky, so... Well, or, you know, yeah, good. Well, maybe I'll end up repeating things you already know, but it looks like most of the group we can start there. But, you know, I'm going to give a quatrain from Rumi, and you might say each type of writing that Rumi did was a different kind of mirror. The quatrains really, they're only two lines, and Persian really break them up into four, so we call them quatrains. But they're so intensely compressed that it's like they can deal with an emotion in a moment at the same time as they convey its whole cosmic context. It's wonderful as a spiritual teacher. It's like, you know, every quatrain is like a koan that way. It's like it transforms you, and at the same time it conveys where our situation is individually as a whole. How can two little lines in Persian do that? But we'll see it in just a second. A bit like a lot of the Hadith Qudsi of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So then the Rumi's ghazals, which is what most people hear if you don't know Persian, that's mostly what Coleman Barks has translated, and that's the stuff that people know. Interesting enough, their ghazals are very different in the hands of different writers. But in Rumi, they're almost musical riffs on a particular emotion, totally different than the ghazals of Hafez, for example, or of Attar. But they're not so much teaching as they are, and that's why they're so popular, is they say what we all wish we could say at our deepest points of learning in life. And so, yeah, of course, you fall in love with the ghazals of Divan HaShams. And then there's the Masnavi. And I started out in this path at age 19 when somebody in our Islamic Civ course, stuck the Masnavi in front of me. And I went back and read it this time, this new book I hadn't touched in years, book three. I felt like I was reading it all over again. And what it does, and I'm going to have to sort of switch over from Ibn Arabi to Rumi now that I've done this. It'll take a while, but I'll get the students to come with me. Because what the Masnavi does is it keeps you in this state of constantly turning around. It's like your head is spinning. When you have that expression of that feeling of your head literally spinning, You don't have to turn. Rumi will turn you when you're going through the Masnavi, because at one moment you're in your experience, at another moment you're in your thoughts about it, and at yet another moment you're in kind of your puzzlement and sense of mystery of what's going on. And from line to line, and this is why I hope we soon get a really accurate literal English translation, because Nicholson's a struggle. It's, even though I grew up in the sort of King James or English that he uses, we do need one. So what I've tried to do here, and it took a lot of effort, is try to pull out of Book 3 the essential points that Rumi is saying about testing, even, and testing is the process of return, when you start reducing, you can't reduce Rumi to the gist of something. But what he's always doing is evoking our own experience of what he wants to talk about, like a wonderful filmmakers do. So the place I thought I would start is with this quatrain sung by Shahram Nazari. If you look it up, it's quatrain 328 in the Firuzanfar's edition, in the one-volume version. There's a wonderful website in the sense of wanting to study these things that gives all the translations now of the different quatrains. And I need to say a couple things about it before we listen to it. First of all, the only reason I'm giving this is to give you time to kind of, I should put it before the Masnavi. What I'd like to ask you to do is think of one particular important course of testing with a capital T in your life, and think about what it is you learned from it and how you learned it. That's what I'm really interested in, because Rumi doesn't tell us the how, nor does he really tell every, and the important thing here is it has to be something, a test that you went through, because you could take 10 people, they have a car accident out in front of here, and for some of them it would be a test for something, who knows what it would be, but it would be something totally different for each person in the same circumstance, the same situation. So it's very important when you kind of listen to Nazari evoking this sense of what it's like to be in the midst of a test with a capital T, that all we can do is, as the Quran says, "Amma bi ni'mati rabbika fahaddith," as far as the grace of your Lord, share it. Because the thing about a test is it takes months or years, and it's only at the end that you realize what it was all about. I mean, you're lucky if in the first year or two you even know it's a test, because for the most part, it takes a while for a test to really, and I'm talking about with a capital T here. I don't think anybody in this group will have trouble coming up with an experience. You don't have to talk about it. Some people may want to share, but I want to get there pretty quickly. But, you know, if you're doing what I remember years ago, my sheikh, you know, I was in a session, and I know Kabir knows about this, but sometimes there are people who just have to talk. Like, you won't think they're a good student if they don't say something. So you had one of these people who was sort of trying to, well, is this little thing happening in my life a test, you know? And he said, and it just has never gone away from me, he said, when you're in a test, you know you're in a test. You don't have to ask your sheikh or anybody else. You know, and that's what I'm talking about, the test with the big T. You know, the hopeless situation you can't get yourself out of. You know you've got to get out of it. Somehow you know God has a purpose in it, and it takes you a long time and much effort and trial to get out of it. So that's what Rumi talks about in Book 3 of the Masnavi. And in fact, it's very interesting because there are plenty of places where he talks, like other Sufi teachers, about the moment-to-moment process of learning and so forth. But in this Book 3 of the Masnavi, he really jumps on the human situation. I mean, what he's talking about here is something that, as Kabir said this morning, about it's the path is something that every soul is on, and tests are an essential part of that. Not because of our belief, they're going to hopefully enrich and deepen our belief, our faith eventually, but that it's something that's built into the human condition. So this quatrain, which says so much about this and is quite sufficient for our purposes here, just a couple things to be said about it. First of all, the word beloved and the word for love and lover and so forth, all those are the same word, dust, yar, which is dust in Persian and then in Turkish, other languages you hear it all the time in Mevlevi music and prayers, is the wali. It's God is al-wali, the source of all caring, guidance. We talked about this 2 years ago, did a whole thing on it with the calligraphy from the Rumi Shrine in Konya. But keep in mind, the friend here, the beloved, is the divine, but in all of her and his expressions. So the awliya, the walis in the plural, walis you would say, awliya is just the Arabic plural, are all of the forms in which that love and caring and guidance impinges on each human being's life. So chances are when Rumi in the bottom of that page is talking about the saints that are hidden, what he's really talking about is your next door neighbor, the person who's sitting on your right or your left or whatever. So don't think you have to go, off to the jungle or the desert or some Himalayas to find these hidden awliya. If those people are touching and transforming and caring for you, chances are they're among those hidden awliya that he's talking about here. So there's a love poem dimension to this, because love is what carries us through this return to love, this returning process. But the paradox that this poem focuses on is that God brings us back through care and affliction, here. And I think that's what this book three is about, because, the first thing, if you try and tell your children, as we sometimes do, I really need to punish you or set down guidelines or limits or whatever, because that's the only way you're going to grow up into being an adult. What's the usual reaction? You can even tell them, like my dad did, it hurts me more than it hurts you. You ever hear that one? All these unbelievable parental expressions. Okay, so that's why these are hard lessons, in book three of the Masnavi, because, and the word heartbreak here, it's literally translated from the Persian, Dil Shikastagi, but the important thing is it's not something that leads to despair. It's not sadness in itself. It's what it takes to break through all the accoutrements of the nafs, accoutrements of habit and conditioning and so forth, which surround our heart so that our heart can actually receive what it's meant to receive. So is that clear? Because I'm not sure the English word heartbreak, even though it translates literally to Persian, does that. Ibn Arabi has, I wish I had a way to draw it up here, when he's talking about the sadr, which in the Quran is what covers the heart, and it has to be uncovered. Lam nashra laka sadrak. It has to be almost operated on so our heart can open up. He says the word sod in the, I wish I had it here. But anyway, let's see, if I do it like that, does that look like the word, the letter sod, the beginning of sadr, for those of you who know Arabic? Because it's wonderful, because it's like a bowl, which is the open heart. And then the beginning of it is like the lid. It's almost like a Weber barbecue letter, So he says, the letter sadr is like, the sadr should be open so that our heart can receive what it is meant to receive, the divine light, the divine lessons at all times. So if the heart is open, it's like the sadr, the letter sadr there, which is just like a bowl there, ready to receive that water and light of grace. So there's a pun that goes all the way through this, is to have a friend is how you say to love in Persian. So you'll hear these same words, dust and daram, again and again in the four short lines of this poem. Anything else I need to say there? Yeah, so the last part, where it says both, why heartbreak in Iowa is always at God's door, because he loves a broken heart, or in the same last line, it's also, like a true lover, she too has a broken heart. So how can God have a broken heart? Well, if you think of the key moments in the lives of the prophets, Gethsemane, for example, or think even the highest of the prophets, or of the Sanat al-Huzn, the year of Huzn, the year of the prophet when everything in Mecca went wrong and it looked like everything he had worked for was going to fall apart. So notice that there the broken heart is the prelude to his feeling the nafas al-Rahman, the divine breath from the auspicious place, from heaven, nafas al-Rahman, long before the actual occurrence of what God brings to save him, to save his community, to save his mission, and so forth. So even the prophets have to go through, according to at least, or they go through to show us, to teach us in any case, the same kind of lesson that's contained here. Also in this intense compression, like a true lover, God's having a broken heart. A couple of hadith qudsi, as you get used to Rumi's quatrains, you'll see he's doing what Kabir rightly said last night, we all have to do, which is we have to take the lessons and bring them into the world, into the terms that people can understand today. At least that's what I understood you to say last night. I think it's what we have to do as a trade all the time. And in doing so, you can see the sort of locus classicus. There's a couple of hadith qudsi of where God speaks, I was a hidden treasure and I love to be known. So I created creation, human beings, so that I might be known. But obviously there's this intense divine longing to be known, and that intense loneliness that evokes, and that the act of creation, the creation that we experience at all times, is the expression of that desire to overcome that loneliness and to do so through sharing, which is only possible through the heart. The other one, of course, is hadith of Jahannam, or I mean, it's actually part of a much larger hadith, but I was sick. You know, God tells the soul the last day, I was sick, you didn't visit me. I was hungry, you didn't feed me. And then he explains that, thirsty, you didn't give me to drink. And then my servant so-and-so was that way. So again, that hadith expresses the fact that in all the suffering that we go through, can you imagine it multiplied 6 billion times? That's what's on this planet, what God is experiencing at every instant is 6 billion, add another 10 million every day or so. Just imagine, this is what Rumi is trying to get us to experience, this big picture as well as the little picture of how our heart is growing and expanding. So this was from this ancient recording of Shahram Nazari that a lot of you probably heard, doing some quatrains and a kind of westernized music at the time, but it's 1 minute long, won't bore you, but the words in English are what you have in the upper right of the handout here. So. Go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry, I like to hear him over and over again. It's like a zikr. I hope you... Are you the only one here who has Persian here besides... Yeah. But if everybody else, I don't know whether it comes across or not, but this guy's a pretty good singer. Every time we're in Konya at the worst time, he's always there like the rock star of the day, kind of singing much bigger
singing
groups.
Singing for free.
Yeah. Oh, does he?
People's homes and various places. Yeah.
Yeah. He's just
he
all
just
over.
Moves around. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a real lover of Mevlana. So I'm gonna. You don't really need all of what I wrote here, but I just kind of wanted to say that Rumi keeps coming back on how the really important lessons, the transforming lessons in life, are the hard ones, and you know, and he does it with such intensity. And I mean, there were, I think Corey's remark in one of the passages I picked, she said, "Erg!" You know, I don't know, how do you say that exactly? I don't know. Don't use that one. And it wasn't the one where he talks about the woman who has 20 children and all of them die at 3 months. And then what happens when she goes to paradise and all that, I couldn't even dare to put in here. I knew it wouldn't pass muster with her. So They're tough lessons, but let me come back to what we've been talking about, because what he's saying here really makes sense in terms of this muraqabah at a deeper level. And what happens, you all know the ayah of the Quran, لِلَّهِ الْمَغْرِبِ وَالْمَشْرِقِ, to gods, or gods are the places of setting light and of growing light. East or west doesn't really catch that, but of illumination, of darkening. So wherever you turn around, there is the face of God. Now, as with many ayahs in the Quran, people say, oh, well, God's everywhere. Okay. That isn't what it's saying exactly. It's saying that God is manifest in very different ways, in different experiences, and in all of creation. Some of them appear to us as places where light is dawning, and you know, so on the sort of naturalistic, from the point of view of the nafs or of the carnal self or the ego or whatever, what are you going to do when you're in a rough spot and all the light's disappearing? Which direction are you going to turn? Towards the mashrik, towards the place where, oh, more light, and so forth. And the problem is that if we let our ego run our spiritual life, we will always turn towards what seems more pleasurable or what will rescue us from pain. You've heard that from Mahmud, right? You've heard it from, I think we've all been saying that in one way or another. And so what we call tests are the ways in which the hidden, our hidden darknesses, our hidden lack of faith, our hidden taken-for-grantedness, our hidden weaknesses in all sorts of aspects, these are the situations in life that reveal to us what we would never see if we just kept turning towards the brighter lights, the happiness, turned toward the gardens, and we didn't turn around and actually face what is hidden within ourselves. Now, if you've got a really good sheikh and master and teacher, whether in this world or the other world, one of the things they will do, of course, is try and speak, convey to us. It can be your, you know, at the very least, spouses can do this, even without spiritual guidance. You know, you've got a weak point here. It's time to work on it or whatever. What happens in the course of life when somebody points out a weak point? But it's not a test. They just point out this kind of weak point or lack of faith, as I said, or something where we always tend to get it wrong or always give in. What usually happens? Most people here have been in a relationship, even if you, you know, that's, I mean, that's one of the specialties of couples, you know, is to point these things out. You deny it, you get angry, it's kind of like Bart Simpson's spiritual life, you know. I mean, so I wasn't there, I didn't do it, you know, all the other things. But above all, we just won't work on it, you know. So the world is constructed in such a strange way. And this is, I couldn't even sleep last night because I was doing what I had just asked you to do, is kind of go back and look at the big tests with a capital T in life. And notice that there's situations we get ourselves into, they're defined by the fact that we can't get ourselves out of them to start with. If we could, it wouldn't be a test any longer. I mean, we can try, but the really big ones are ones we literally cannot get ourselves out of. And I think most people here have been through this cycle enough to realize that it's no coincidence that this particular test is happening. It's very hard to talk about it. And when you read the book Masnavi, you can fall into what our society wants us to think, is that tests are about bad things happening to good people, or maybe good things happening to bad people. But either way, it's not about the things that happen. It's about the situation we find ourselves put in, where we are miserable, suffering, wanting to change that situation, and are unable to do so. And the reason it's so important to give a little time and thought to reflection to this, which Rumi gives a whole book to in the Masnavi, is that, well, partly because we can perhaps move through them a little faster and move ahead a little faster, but it's just because, and that's why I wanted to, maybe somebody could talk about, I can always jump in, I'd rather not. Nobody wants to talk about their tests. But as I said, I'm not interested in the tests. I'm interested in how we learn from them and where. And because this is the mystery. It's like tests are God's trying to teach us something that if we knew it, not intellectually, but if we knew it existentially, if we had already been transformed, if we'd been what the metaphor he uses in a lot of these stories is being cooked, if the fire had transformed us and cooked us, then we wouldn't be in the test anymore. You know, can I also say, is it interesting, have you always noticed that sometimes tests end very dramatically with an illumination, but often they end in such a way you look back and said, how could I have considered that a test? You know, it's like you even don't want to even bother talking about it because it seems like that pitfall or that weakness, that troubling spot that we had in ourselves, once we're past it, it's like, oh, yeah, you know. And that's why it's very important not ever to worry about the tests of other people, because some of them are going to look Herculean and impossible and Sisyphean, others are going to look really easy, you know. But we all know this about tests, and this is what Rumi writes in such a way that he wants us to look at the things, either the tests that we passed or the tests that we find ourselves in. And that's very different because our mind, you know, the chatterbox, nafs, mind, well, when you turn your attention to these things, it will do anything it can to get away from looking at what God wants us to look at in the midst of a test. And in fact, when I read this, I was really troubled by book three of Rumi's Mastavi, I must say, because he kept saying stuff that is so contrary to the society and the world we live in today that it sounded almost like either medieval or something. Because, you know, to say to people that, do you kind of realize how everything in the world today, how you sell something is to diminish the pain of people or to increase their esteem of you? All the things that, you went through a pretty good list of points of the nafs. And basically, we live in a society where what we consider success, what is considered things that, well, everything is either to, you know, how are you going to deal with the fact of our mortality? Something that a lot of us, in various ways, as you get older, at least a lot of people are at the age where parents and their generation are going. You know, it's very, you have to, when you can't mitigate pain and sell that, then you have to sell distraction. And, you know, so I'm not here as a social critic. I'm just saying we're not in a society which pays much attention to the tests that everybody around us is going through, because it's not like you sit down in the subway or we walk outside here and we're going to meet people who happily or blissfully have no tests. Sometimes for rhetorical purposes, Rumi will talk about, you know, really rich people who have none of the trials of the peasants and shopkeepers of his day. But he knew very well that the Mongol rulers or the Seljuk rulers or whatever were every bit as being tested as the as his usual audience. So I think, how well have it done? Is that like a half hour, basically? Have we done? How much time have I used up?
Oh, 35 minutes?
Yeah, just a little over. So what I'm interested in, and I can only hear about it, is from people who might be willing to talk about it, I'll go somewhere else, again, earlier, I think Kabir talked about tahliya or tahali in the Sufi typology. You have to sort of empty your lower self in such a way that you can begin to take on the attributes, tahaluk, the attributes and qualities of God, and eventually even those of ahak, tahakuk, even comes beyond that, sort of deeply realizing it, so that you become one of these awliya, become one of these friends who is doing God's work in the world consciously and not just unconsciously. But I think that we just have to kind of look at what Rumi has pointed us towards here and look at the mystery. It's not how we get a test solved, but where that answer comes from and how we're changed by it. Because another problem with our society is instead of looking at spirituality in its whole, we look at it as a set of problems. And we have a problem-solving society. I'm a problem-solving person. I got ahead in life by solving problems. So it just builds up your ego again and again to think that all problems are ones that we're meant to solve and we have a solution for. Because a test is something where the solution lies in our depths or beyond ourselves. You can use either language because that sometimes it's something we didn't know we had within ourselves, and other times it's something that comes to us from the outside. But the transformation that Rumi talks about here in the first page when he says, he talks about it as a second birth after the first birth of soul, the birth into spiritual life, and how we have to wean ourselves from this world and develop a taste for spiritual food and spiritual drink. The word just used here is throat. It doesn't work very well in English. And then, of course, the first thing he talks about, just to kind of cover some of his practical bases, says you have to die to this world. Well, good luck in doing it by yourself. Then you have to turn to the saints, to the friends, to the awliya, to the prophets and all, but those who call, guide, and rescue us from this. In the next page, he talks about aspiration, developing desire, spiritual desire to get out of this. Well, again, tests are wonderful for developing our spiritual desire because the first thing they do is destroy our egoistic desire, and then they work on, we have to start working on praying deeper, praying harder, finding, looking, and that seeking and searching is the outward expression, or the practical expression of aspiration or himma. And we have to, it certainly speeds things up if we're with people, being the neighbor of companions of other seekers. And then just to run through these when you take them home, but that process leads to pure needfulness, niyaz, thirst, and that's the key to finding where and how to seek. Striving to recognize the purpose behind life's afflictions, keeping the right companions. And finally, it's worth reading the story. Everybody knows the story of the chickpea and the housewife, but reading sort of everything, it really, when you read it closely, it gives the full picture of why we're here and why those or other people are here to help us learn. So let's see what kind of learning you can share, as I said. By the way, another way of talking about this is, I thought of the title, but I would rob it from Birdman, the movie. Remember the subtitle of that, those of you who've seen it? The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance? Well, book three of the Masnavi is about the unexpected virtue of ignorance because it's about spiritual ignorance. It's like, oh, I've read the, you know, I do everything Islam says or whatever religion says. I've read it all or whatever. And in that book, he just kind of constantly throws out stories that make us realize that we are ignorant. If we're in a test, we're ignorant. That's why we're in that test, is to learn something that we may think we know the verbal answers to. And, oh, the one I just loved is the one on page 2 here about the lover who comes and reads his love letters to the beloved. And it's clear in the context that Rumi is talking about somebody who really knows the Quran and is praying the verses of the Quran all the time, rather than prayer is meant to be the musamara, the evening encounter of the lover and the beloved. And sure, the love letters are good in opening the door, but once you're in with the beloved, there's more to learn than just reciting more of the Quran, which is God's love letter, the beloved's love letter to each of us, and our love letter that we recite in return to try and open the door to the boudoir, if you will, to the intimacy of uns. One thing I mentioned is when you go back and look for the big tests in your life, before 28, everything was a muddle for me. I don't know whether this had to do with age, but it was about that time that I really found spiritual path, a master, and so forth. And after that, it's like, well, at least I know I'm in a test as I go through things. I'm sure I had them before that, but I couldn't say easily what they were or how they worked. So as you go through life, you do learn, not how to quickly solve them, but you do at least I'm in a test. You learn pretty quickly what the weak point is, and you learn that you've got to do something deeper and more sincerely. It's said, you could call this sabr. You can give the whole list of sabr, tawakkul, you know, all the Islamic virtues. They all have English letter equivalents, but we think we know what those virtues are, but tests are when we actually learn what they are. So does anybody have one that's anodyne enough that it's not going to shock people and not going to embarrass you to share about it?
It is
any test is embarrassing, so thank you for speaking up all the same. Okay.
Okay. I come from a family of vegetable peddlers, and we're just used to shouting. Uh-huh. Okay, this was 25 years ago, which means I was 42.
Yeah.
This is already embarrassing. It was an obsessive love affair.
Yeah.
I mean, it was manic, clinically manic.
Wow.
And
just like Rumi's poem.
Oh, yeah. And I was off the charts crazy. I could tell you that the telephone was about to ring and who was on the line, and it would be happening, because this enters into the other kind of time.
Yeah, time beyond time. Yeah.
Yeah. Not Kronos, but Kairos.
Yeah.
And it just tore me to shreds. Everyone who knew me was just sort of watching and shaking their head, wondering how small the shreds were going to be at the end.
Yeah.
And to make a long story short, when it was all over, there was very little left of me. And that was the point of the test. And it was wonderful.
Nisti, nothingness, yeah. That's the point of every test.
And my life from that point on, even financially, improved because I had been reduced to nothing.
Yeah. I think it's one of the passages here he comments in the thing that always comes up from the Quran, in the malos rios ren, in the malos rios, and with every difficulty, there's a release, happiness, and so forth. And of course, this is something that the religions, not just Islam, all teach. But as you just said about that, it's like one of the things that keeps us locked. You know, a lot of tests have to. The things we keep most deeply buried are really terrors for us. And so it's those fears and terrors that really lock us very often into the tested situation until they gradually or suddenly burn away. And so one of the things when you're in it is, I can't do anything about it because it would only make it worse, you know, that, you know, especially in the kind of situation you've just described there. So how many people, by the way, so I don't want George to feel bad here. How many people have been through exactly what he describes? Come on, at some point in life. And not just in high school, you know. Yeah, so it's the majority, you know. So you've just shared for everyone. And, you know, one of the things Rumi loves to do, and we all know these kind of stories, he loves to show how the makrullah, God's deciding things. Another way of talking about this book is it's about inayah, about God's loving care for each of us. But a big part of that is exposing the things we're trying to keep hidden, because until those fears and it gets way beyond pleasure and pain, but you know, it's really fear is the deepest thing here, I think, in most people running them. And these aren't just funny stories. He makes them funny because any other way of talking about it would terrify people, you know. So, and that's why I said this is homework more than it is for work here. but you, thank you for sharing that and for bringing that out. And by the way, what brought it to a calm and happy ending? I mean, where did that come from? Exhaustion. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, that may be. Yeah. Becky. Can you just say your first name?
Juwaria.
Juwaria.
I have a similar story, but I think it has a different ending.
Yeah.
And what happened to me, I think I met my Layla, and I was like Majnun with this guy. And what I walked away from it with was a sense of what divine love felt like, because I was like intoxicated with this guy. And then what I got from it was that I had to love me, myself, a little more than what I was putting out. And I think I sort of turned to myself, my true self, I think, more. And what I noticed when I started to see him, I was saying to myself, well, what the hell was that about? Because he lost that meaning that I made so important to me. So I walked away changed by it and also thankful for the experience of what it really feels like to love when your heart is open.
Yeah. And thank you, because you've just reminded me of something I had wanted to mention about this in the Masnavi, is we need to keep in mind that this is so autobiographical, that everything he's writing about is, you know, rooted in how does this university professor, Madrasa, bigwig in town, okay, he has a great Sufi father, but we don't have much evidence of Mevlana himself. He didn't leave diaries of his spiritual experiences and all like his father did. So it seems like it's like meeting Shams was this key that changed him. You know, the first story, what everything, by the way, that he mentions here in book three, he mentions in the first story of book one. You know, the king, this disaster happens to the king, he falls in love, and he goes immediately to the mosque and never stops praying until, in the other world, he meets the wali, who then sends him the help and guidance and all that he needs. I mean, in the story, he goes there immediately. But first of all, how long does it take us when we fall into a test to start turning to God rather than looking for some placebo drugstore version of test resistors? I mean, I think, you know, in my mind, it's like, well, the first place you go is God. But usually you don't realize it's a test until you've tried everything else in your human powers. About a year, I think, for most big tests, it seems like a year. You're just in the pain, and you think, there's surely some way out of this. I'll see a new therapist. I'll do body work. I'll come to Garrison 3 times a month, you know, this kind of thing, until you realize that, no, there's a message in this. But to complete the Rumi story, I think what's missing there, and thank you for all your wonderful work with Maqalat al-Shams and everything like that, because it fleshes out Rumi and Shams, and you realize, and when you read which we can't very easily in English because they're kind of all pieced apart, but the Divan of Shams, so much of it is in this agony of losing Shams, and losing him once when he goes away, and the second time when he disappears or dies or whatever. And also, there's got to have been some professional agony there for Rumi about, you know, as I said, no professor could hold on to their job in America today if they ran into their Shams and started spending all their time in closed rooms with him. You know, it's just, you know, they're going to find some way to get you out of the university, you know. And so in this case, the people who seem to have broken with him most were his oldest son and his disciples and, you know, the people who upheld his reputation and thought that they were the apple of his eye, and suddenly this wandering dervish boy comes in. However, you understand Shams. I mean, everybody has a different picture. But that had to be hard, you know. And when he writes about the suffering and the heart's blood and all of these things, you know, it cannot have been just blissfully glorious, although it may have been for a while. But certainly once Shams is gone, the wisdom of the Masnavi is the distillation of loss leading back to a deeper presence. And so it's so helpful to see that Rumi himself is writing about stuff that he went through. He's not writing as like a person who's in seventh heaven above it all, kind of looking down on earth, but he's somebody for whom these things became true through his experience. He wants to get you the microphone.
Bismillah. In my experience, what was hard to explain when I was in the big T, which lasted for about 10 years, yeah. I felt, and I couldn't explain it to people, that I couldn't go till I got permission to go. Mm-hmm. And as irrational as that seemed, because I tried to leave, and I came back. Now you could look at
took me
a cycle.
30 years, so.
What is that?
It took me 30 years. Yeah. Don't feel bad.
And I couldn't explain it to anybody rationally, but I knew and I trusted that when I had permission to go, I would go.
Yeah.
And I did. And but it was I couldn't explain it to anybody, mm-hmm. because it was like, well, just leave. As, you know, as horrible as things got. So I think that was, and it wasn't as if there was any big thing that happened. Mm-hmm. It was just time, and I was done or something. And I'm still working on, or I'm still learning from that. You know,
yeah.
I'm still learning from that.
Yeah. Can I just say, we're really getting started, but there's something important I wanted to mention. One thing, way of looking at this, what Rumi wants us to see about life, is do some of you know about the 99 names? Oh, I know the Muslims would. 99 names of God. We've got them up in the wall in our hallway and so forth. Look, the names are infinite. I mean, it isn't about the number here, but it's like if you look at those names, there are a bunch of them that the nafs loves, and there are a bunch of them that the nafs doesn't want to go near with a 10-foot pole. You know what I mean? So let me give you an example. I mean, a Jabbar. You know, book three here is about a Jabbar. You know, realizing that we're only in control in our lives when we're doing God's will, which isn't that often. You know? And for the rest of the time, he's in charge, you know, or she here, you know, however we conceive of that. So, but you go, and, you know, we want to have the names we like. Al-Muhi, wonderful. You know, I want to have 10 kids. Al-Mumit, I haven't gotten to the point where that's one I want to, you know, really spend a lot of time with, the one who dies, the one who gives life as opposed to the one who kills. Al-Mundakim, we'd like to be just a Rahman, a Rahim, and not realize, you know, that isn't just something that governments take care of or whatever. We have responsibilities. There can't be any justice without intikam of some sort, not what vengeance would convey in English, but it's almost like you kind of look at these 99 names and see which, and of course you can't really know God in terms of the good ones until the whole point of being on earth is so we can experience the deprivations or the contraries of these good ones. So, but I think for all of us, even when you're not in a test, you can kind of look at those 99 names and almost immediately see which ones you're going to get tested on. Sort of anything you don't want to think about and experience, guess what? The next one coming down. It's like after a while you begin to feel like you're a human bowling pin, you know, and the ball is God's will, you know, or God's providence. And I is like caring for us or whatever, but, you know, until we've kind of covered all of those pins and really undergone them, we protect ourselves, as Mahmoud was saying this morning. So testing is God's way of opening up our heart to these things that we won't do on our own, you know. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not glorifying suffering. I hope nobody's getting that idea, because you can get the idea even from reading a lot of Rumi here in book three. But it's just that we can learn to pay attention to the lessons that really count. Yeah. And, you know, the point in that process when you decide, well, I'll wait for permission, that's already Nusra min Allah. You know, that's the grace. The rest is just time, you know, the petty time, not the big time. So other hands were up. Yeah. Yeah. You want to just down here, please? Down here?
Tom had his.
Okay. Sorry, we'll get to you.
This story is about work and a job,
yeah,
and time. And I had a great job. Mm-hmm. I was a teacher, and I loved my job. I got all summer off.
Yeah.
And then I was seduced into taking a job at a bank. Yeah. Okay. It was sort of a family business. Yeah. The pitch was a play to my ego. Mm-hmm. It was more money. And so I went with it. I got a leave of absence, 1 year. Okay. I extended the leave of absence foolishly to 2 years. Mm-hmm. 2 years went by, and I was doing okay. My leave of absence was done. I was now into it. The test has really come. Things are going downhill. You know, in banks, there's up cycles and down cycles. Well, I hit the down cycle. And I began working with people I knew, Community Bank, who were having difficulties. Okay, I was having difficulties dealing with them. This went on for quite a few years, having to foreclose on my neighbors. Not a fun thing. For some reason, I started reading weekly meetings of Gurdjieff groups. And I also, thanks to Kabir, began the 99-day program, I think it was. And I began learning the 99 names. And I did this in desperation for, 2 years, over 2 years. And I finally got to Sabir. And on the week that I got from Sabir, my...
Patience, wife, perseverance.
Yeah, my wife calls me up, and she says to me, your old boss wants to talk to you. He's going to offer you a job. And he did. And I took it, and I left the bank and so forth. And it really had to do with divine grace. It had to do with, I think it had to do with ego, mm-hmm. not giving up, income. Yeah. And that was a test. It was altogether 7 years.
Yeah. They're never, if they're that short, you're not going to remember it. you don't forget these long ones. Yeah. And a couple of things there. One is that so often happens, if I were going to give mine, and it's often it was that the yosra, the untying of the knot comes as soon as you give up your own efforts. It's amazing, but you might say, oh well, then why don't you give up your efforts sooner? But you can't. You have to exhaust everything your ego can think of before grace has a way to kind of make its way into the heart. And it sounds magical if you describe it to someone else, but when this has happened 3 or 4 or 5 times in life, as if you've lived this long, probably has, you begin to recognize that literally that the hand of God is above their hands, is to cite the ayah that Kabir mentioned earlier. Yeah. The other thing also what Rumi really digs into in this book is we live, our nafs lives in a dualistic universe. It's a, they would say, a hafez or whatever, say, nafses are Zoroastrians, you know? That's a slur on Zoroastrians. They weren't dualists, but I mean, there was sort of this reputation of God of evil, Zervan, and who's Ahriman, and so forth. So one of the things Rumi and Tess force us to see is that the things that we consider to us evil, which is usually dangerous or fearful or frightening or whatever, that they're not, that they're serving a purpose. The temptations are serving the purpose of bringing us out, bringing our depths out, our despair out, whatever it might be. You know, I don't want to turn this into a 12-step session, but you know, but the 12 steps have a lot to say about these different stages of the testing process, and most people here are acquainted with them anyway. So But I think that's, I mean, how many times when you're in a test, are you sure that the other person is out to get you, demonic, diabolical, whatever? I mean, okay, there's a lot of psychologists in the room, and I can see this is like bread and butter for psychologists, but for the rest of us who aren't so used to seeing the anima or whatever it is projected out there in other people in the world, Rumi really wants to turn us into monotheists and see that these things that we take to be negative and tempting and destructive and all, that they really are part of this divine purpose, which he always comes back to. And I don't think that's a lesson like the lesson about in the Malosri, you know, that with the bad comes something good. It's one you have to learn. You know, we have to learn about each person we've cast as a devil or tempter or negative person or whatever. But I assume most people have had that experience of going from seeing somebody else as like totally negative to realizing that they maybe were doing you a good turn. Jacob's Ladder is a wonderful film about that, where the angel Gabriel appears as a chiropractor in the middle and says, oh, you thought, and you know, you think this is a horror movie, you know, and then he says, oh no, you know, all of these forces that you're trying to detach your nafs from this world so that your spirit could return to God, you saw them all as devils, but once you realize that they're trying to release you, they're angels, and that are out to release you, and it just like snap in the middle of the movie, and so much so often tests are that way, that once we are through them, we realize that no time was wasted. I think that's one thing that Rumi wants us to see, and it's very hard. He constantly, in Book 3, refers to what George called about, there's like the time of clocks, you know, that time of years and months and so forth. And then there's that time of, you called it kairos, the waqt, the Sufi term would be the waqt or the instant or whatever, when everything turns. And we live, you know, our spirit lives almost entirely in that world. Sometimes it opens up too much and we get kind of crazy for a while. But that's part of it, is realizing that every step. Is there anybody here who, like, regrets the test you went through? You have one, okay. But no, it's not a common experience, usually at the end. And that's what he's trying to get us to see as well, is to just notice that in the end, mostly the tests lead to something that we feel was a good investment, even though at the time it looked impossible. Yeah, go ahead. Maybe yours isn't over, by the way. Go ahead if you want to talk about it.
Yeah. Martin.
And the lady down here, too, has been ready to talk for a while. So, right down here.
I used to joke to myself, you know, like that aphorism, smile in the world smiles with you, you know, yeah. Laughing. I mean, crying, you cry alone, and my own was bitter and the world laughs at you. So it's kind of a combination of, well, I was seeing it, but I was ignoring what I was seeing, and so that I regret. And it's like Kadeem said, it was a failed love affair that lasted about 10 years. And I do use the word failure because even though all the things that you said are really true, it still feels like a failure. Mm-hmm. Like, because if only, and of course this is so ridiculous to say that, if only I had recognized things earlier or seen, you know, or whatever. And in this case, this wasn't a typical, like, lifetime kind of story thing where it was someone that I didn't see that they were really all wrong for me, and now I'm left them, and now my life is so much better. It wasn't like that. It was actually, I was the selfish one, and I didn't see that. And one of the things that you learn as you become an adult is that some things are really too late.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not very spiritual of me, but I'm still learning from it, and I'm still doing some of the same things, but I'm trying to, like you said earlier, I'm really trying to make the time when I recognize that it's a test a little earlier, so it doesn't last quite so long. So.
Yeah. While we're waiting for the mic to move down here, yeah, you reminded me when you said lifetime. As I was reading these tough stories that Rumi uses to illustrate how God's love is not always looking like love in first encounter, and that's to put it mildly, it struck me that the one place that is allowed in our culture is in the waiting room and checkout magazines. That the kinds of stories... Would you say that, Corey? The kind of the stories you said you can't use that. Those are the kinds that you guys, you know, of the like terrible undeserved sufferings and people who come through them and so forth. And it says something about our culture that those are the places. And I understand the hospital waiting rooms, doctors' offices. It's a good place to read about people who have it worse than you. But that's not the purpose for which Rumi wants us to look at these things in life. So, yeah, go ahead.
Hello, my name is Sarah, and it's my first time being here in the group. I'm very thankful. I experienced, as our other brother and sister explained about it, but what I would like to share is the cure was embedded in the pain.
Oh, yeah.
And as Rumi himself said in a poem... And
I was going to say, there are quite a few quatrains about this.
Future permission in Persian, it says, گفتا به صدف مانی کو دور به شکم دارد تا نشکنی ای شیدا آن دور نشود پیدا. And as a resemblance of that, I translate that. I wear this bracelet. It's the same thing. I remember... Yeah. Unless I break, then the beauty can show. So this way I can tolerate my pain easier. Yeah. And basically it says that ask the lover, don't break me with your hardship. And beloved says, you are like a mother pearl. Unless you break, the real pearl will show, and this is why you have to be broken.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is what I learned that I always carry with myself.
I think we've used up the time, and I just wanted to say one more thing about when you take this home. That's beautiful, and I always love the way he takes, like in Arabic, the hadith is likulida and dawain. And so the Arabic gets expanded in the Persian, and then we have to expand it. But the one thing I would say is pay attention to where he talks. He comes back again and again to the awliya, to the instruments of God's grace, guidance. Friend is so weak, and there's no simple word, but grace, guidance, help, succor, all of those things. You notice that in real life, those are sometimes earthly people, sometimes. You know, one of the things tests do is when you read Rumi, there's kind of the half of the world you can see, which is dunya, and then there's this other world, which is more starts out as being a world of beliefs at best, the kind of hypothetical world, the spiritual world. First it's hypothetical, then it's belief. Then each experience of a testing is like one of these, I can't think of what, I don't even know what we call them, but like we used to do them for Halloween. You'd make a painting and then you'd put it all over in black. Did you do that with pastel, black pastel? And then you'd kind of put squiggles through it and so forth. You start to make this work of art. Well, think of the Masnavi, think of life as it's kind of like we have this eraser to scrape off the black. And every time we go through a test, it's like we're scraping off some of this blackness that hides the reality, not the existence, but the reality and the intimacy of that world of grace and hope, the world of the awliya, the world of al-wali. And we can't, don't get stuck on this is the wali or this. As he says, you know, the main thing he says, these are my dervishes. They are 100,000,000, and yet they are one, you know. So every test is kind of, you know, you may only see this piece of the picture, that piece of the picture, but every time we're brought through one, we're transformed. And as we're transformed, the one way you can tell is you just see the reality of God's hand in everything that happens to us.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Thank you.
Wasn't too simple, was it?
Beautiful.
Okay.
And for those who wish, I think we're going to have afternoon salat in the other room in a few minutes, and then dinner at 6. So thank you. Salam. Yeah, okay, get a microphone so we can hear you.
So this evening, they'll be serving dessert with dinner. However, the dessert they serve at dinner time will be for the other people because they're saving our dessert so we can have it after our evening, our last evening session. So please hold off getting dessert at dinner time, and we'll have it later. We will put that out as well. We won't put it out at dinner time. Thank you. So, thank you. Oh, yes. And they would like us to be out of our rooms by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And they will put out bins in the hallways to put the sheets. There's one for the sheets and one for the towels, and the bedspread gets left on the bed. So, and you can bring your things and put them in the hallway here or in the foyer, and they'll be safe there. And if you're taking the train into New York City tomorrow to make a flight, please sign up on the bulletin board out there. Because there's limited spaces, so if you have to be someplace at a certain time, be sure you sign up. And I actually would do that if you're, you know, after prayers or before dinner, so that you can get the spot that you need. The shuttle to Grand Central Station.
The shuttle
It's a shuttle to the train that takes you to Grand Central Station, yes.
Okay. Good.